From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic has been a devastating blow to countries, societies, communities, families, children, the elderly, and everyone in between. With nearly 500,000 deaths in the past year in the United States alone, the crisis is akin to a near-death experience for our society. Assuming we survive, should we not take stock of what is needed to happen in order to minimize the damage so that the next time we'll be better prepared? Or better yet, shouldn't we ensure that there is no next time? In a new book called Pandemic Pivot, my guest John Pfeffer has called together the work of a group of global progressive thinkers and experts who examined how our current systems failed us and what we can do to fix them. John Pfeffer is Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the author of Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and the Splinterlands Trilogy. He joins me to discuss Pandemic Pivot, a report from the Institute for Policy Studies, the Transnational Institute, and Focus on the Global South. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
So first, tell me how this book came about. This is the sort of collective work of a number of thinkers, and you've written a report based on discussions that took place last year?
That's correct. Back in the spring, we realized at the Institute for Policy Studies that there was really no going back to the status quo that existed prior to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. In other words, the situation prior to the pandemic was a pretty lousy situation if you take into account the economic inequality, the risk of climate crisis, etc. And so we wanted to talk to people around the world about how we could use this terrible situation to pivot to an entirely different kind of global economy, global society, U.S. foreign policy, et cetera. And so we brought together people to have discussions along eight different issue areas. And out of that, we produced this book.
And those issue areas include things like the economy, like climate change, et cetera, right? And also the immigration crisis, the issue around authoritarianism, right? The rise of right-wing authoritarianism. So all of these trends that it seems as though were already in place before the coronavirus crisis that either became exacerbated during the crisis or were part of the reason why we saw the crisis, right?
That's correct. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the trends away from democracy that have been taking place over the last decade, the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, in many cases, merely accelerated those trends. So, for instance, we saw dictators consolidating their power using the coronavirus as an excuse. And even in democratic societies, we saw leaders like Donald Trump use the coronavirus to exercise his executive authority or to push through an agenda that hitherto had been difficult to push through. For instance, on immigration, we saw tremendous setbacks, progressive setbacks on immigration questions as the Trump administration pushed through its agenda of basically shutting down all immigration and asylum seekers.
So we have many sort of social experiments that have been taking place around the world over the past year because, of course, the pandemic hit different countries in different ways, depending upon the conditions in that country, the response to the crisis, the way in which the governments worked to mitigate it. We had different responses. What are some of the lessons? And we've been covering this on our program, looking at, for example, what did New Zealand do right? What did South Korea do that was that worked for them, et cetera? So what were some of those lessons that you draw on in looking at how countries worked in successful ways to, make a crisis, to minimize a crisis that could have been much worse for them?
Well, the first is that the countries that have been successful largely put forward coordinated national responses. So here in the United States, obviously, we had a patchwork of responses from the federal government, from different states, local authorities. But the countries that were successful, South Korea, Taiwan, New Zealand, as you mentioned, were very effective in coordinating a top-down federal approach or coordinated national approach. That's the first lesson. The second was to really respond very quickly with the technology at hand. And that we saw, for instance, in South Korea with a very robust testing and tracing system that was put in place, as well as technology such as cell phone apps that could help individuals participate in that system. The third was compliance. Here, obviously, in the United States, we've had a large number of people in the country who have simply refused to comply with face mask wearing or gathering in large public meetings. But in the countries that were successful, we saw large percentage of the population, overwhelming percentage, comply with the requirements of dealing with this pandemic. And those were, not compliance that was dictated by the state. This was compliance that really came from the bottom up. That was certainly the case in New Zealand, certainly the case in South Korea.
Which speaks to both a cultural difference in the nation, but also the moral authority from leaders. So I want to sort of step back. Give me a sense of who these thinkers were, whose work you reported on. You write in your book that last summer, the Institute for Policy Studies invited 68 of the world's leading thinkers and activists to participate in 8 in-depth discussions on Zoom. So these weren't just Americans, right? Who were they? Give me a sense of them.
Sure. Well, many of them were leaders of civil society organizations, like Kumba Touré, who's the head of Africa Rising in Africa. She's in Senegal. Or Walden Bella, a sociologist who was founder of Focus on the Global South, which is based in Bangkok in Thailand. But we drew on a variety of different journalists, academics, thinkers, even some policymakers who have been involved in international authorities like the UN, in order to try to bring as much kind of information to the table, as much experience to the table as possible when crafting, well, first of all, when analyzing the situation, trying to figure out, well, how did this go wrong? Why did we respond as a globe so poorly to the COVID crisis compared to, say, SARS or MERS, the previous pandemics? And then once we've kind of figured out the problems, to identify, well, where can we go in different directions? What are the kinds of policy changes we should make, bearing in mind that we're in a very different situation today than we were prior to the onset of this pandemic? So for instance, prior to the pandemic, it would have been very difficult to imagine stimulus package here in the United States of the size that were pushed through during the Trump years, and which is being considered right now in the Biden administration. That kind of magnitude of spending was not on the table. But now that it's on the table, well, can we consider something of equal magnitude when thinking about a Green New Deal, for instance? So the pandemic has, in some ways, opened up certain policy options that were simply not available previously.
One of the things that came about that was just such an important illustration of what economic stimulus can do last year was when the CARES Act passed, and Americans who were struggling, who were unemployed, were able to get $600 a week, the equivalent of $15 an hour if they worked 40 hours a week, and because for those people who were unemployed from the pandemic, that had pretty significant impact, not just on individuals, but on our economy as well, right? Because people could actually buy the things that they needed or pay off the things that they needed to pay off and survive. They didn't fall through the cracks. It helped buoy small businesses. That was a really good illustration of what is possible, say, when In post-pandemic times, we simply have a $15 an hour minimum wage.
I think that's a very good point. But we could also look to what European countries did, or many European countries did, when the pandemic hit. And that was to step in and actually cover the salaries of people in the workplaces, so they didn't have to be unemployed at all. And in fact, what the European Union did as a collective entity in with their stimulus package, which really sought not just to kind of deal with the problem as is, but also sought to reduce the inequalities that had cropped up between countries in the European Union. So a large amount of the EU stimulus package, the bailout package, was in the form of grants and went to the hardest hit countries like Italy and Spain. So this is an opportunity because we recognize that the coronavirus has really sharpened economic inequalities both within countries and between countries. This is an opportunity with our economic responses to address that economic inequality. And the $15 an hour minimum wage, I think, is an excellent example that you bring up.
Let's talk about the Green New Deal with the situation, very rapidly being apparent that we are in the midst of climate change. As you and I speak, of course, the southern United States is in the throes of a very severe winter storm, and our current energy systems are unable to handle it. Fossil fuel pipelines have, frozen, and millions of people are without power. People have already died. There are people trying to warm themselves by running their car in the garage and dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. It's quite tragic to see this unfold in the world's richest country, something we're utterly unprepared for, just as we were utterly unprepared for a pandemic that experts knew would come. So how significant is this idea? And what did the experts that you report on say about a Green New Deal, an idea that seems to address multiple crises in a very elegant manner?
Yes. And as you pointed out at the top of the show, the pandemic in many ways is a wake-up call. It's a recognition that we face an existential crisis, a global crisis as a planet. That's COVID-19, but it's also climate change. And as you mentioned, all of these things that are happening right now in the United States are happening now, and they're happening here. This is very different from what people have said in the past, that the climate crisis is something that happens to other places, to other countries, to small islands, or it will happen sometime in the future, and we don't really have to worry about it right now. But it is clearly a pressing problem, and it's a pressing problem here. The Green New Deal is something that is being offered. It was offered in Congress by the Democrats, and it has been offered in other countries as well as a way of preemptively dealing with the climate crisis by saying, look, we have to put a lot of money into shifting our economies to clean energy, and we can't just do that by economic fiat. We have to really think this through carefully, how we can kind of shift our workforce away from dirty technologies, coal mining, oil and gas production, shift them to solar energy production, clean electricity production, to do so in a way that addresses some of the other problems in our society as well. For instance, the fact that our infrastructure throughout the United States, our roads, our public transportation, our buildings are in terrible repair. So this is an opportunity to kind of apply funds and work to remedying that situation. So the Green New Deal is both a job creation opportunity, a way of shifting away from dirty energy, but also a way of, in many ways, renewing this country. And we see this in other countries as well, where Green New Deals have been offered, whether it's in the European Union or South Korea, and all toward ultimately the ultimate goal, which is shrinking carbon footprints, which we haven't really accomplished, even though we said we would do so as a result of the Paris Climate Accords. But 5 years later, we have not seen any significant shrinkage of these carbon footprints. And that has to happen immediately. and in an accelerated fashion moving forward.
Let's talk about what I think might be our biggest global challenge that also impacts individual nations in a way that's perhaps, you know, incomparable, which is right-wing authoritarianism, the opposition to a Green New Deal, the opposition to a minimum wage, the opposition to the Paris Accord are all rooted in the same forces that we saw manifested on January 6th here in the United States, in the Trump presidency as a whole. I mean, you see, you know, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas denouncing the Green New Deal because Texas is experiencing a power outage. There doesn't even have to be a truthful basis for their claims. Right-wing attacks on progressive policies that can benefit all of us have really hampered any progress in the right direction. So what did the experts that you report on say about countering radical right-wing authoritarianism? You know, Joe Biden can't even definitively push for a federal minimum wage. This Tuesday at the town hall meeting on CNN, when asked about the importance of raising the wage, he said, yes, but we should really understand that small businesses are also going to have trouble. He can't even agree to canceling $50,000 of college debt and says, oh, he has the authority to do it for $10,000, but not $50,000. So the opposition to right-wing authoritarianism is so weak. So I feel like this is our biggest crisis.
I think you're right. And, you know, our experts identified basically a common denominator, which is a denialism, you know, a denialism that the COVID-19 is a real pandemic, that the climate crisis is a real crisis. You know, this denialism even spreads to, conceptions of society, a denial of demographic realities on the ground here in the United States, that this country is becoming less dominated by white people. And that's a demographic reality moving forward. So these denialisms kind of are across the board. In terms of responses, those vary. I mean, obviously, to address the far right, it's necessary to deal with both their an underlying concern that has kind of fueled support for populism, right-wing populism, and that is, you know, a certain amount of anxiety around economic globalization and the fact that people will and have lost jobs as a result of manufacturing moving overseas and the financialization of the economy. So addressing these economic issues is absolutely paramount for any progressive force. Second is to address kind of the digital propagation of far-right ideology. And we've seen the effectiveness of deplatforming, in other words, removing far-right voices from Facebook and from Twitter. You know, the removal of Donald Trump, the removal of QAnon really reduced the amount of misinformation and disinformation that was out there on the web. So those are two kind of important strategies moving forward. Obviously, we would want to see greater strengthening of democratic institutions in general, both here in the United States and globally. We would want to see greater international cooperation that would, you know, kind of knock the legs out from under these right-wing populists. So there are a variety of different strategies I think we have to look at.
When we look at how the right-wing authoritarian response to immigration has been so devastating here in the United States, you know, really resulted in the dehumanization, particularly of brown people, what are some lessons from other parts of the world? Even before, well before the pandemic, we did have a crisis around immigration because, of course, people, large swaths of people in many different parts of the world, we're fleeing war, we're fleeing poverty, we're fleeing violence, much of it fomented by the rich nations that they were fleeing to. We see it not just at the U.S.-Mexico border, we've seen it in Europe, across the Mediterranean, from the global south to European nations. So what did we see, first of all, transpiring, in terms of how governments responded to the pandemic and scapegoated immigrants? We know in the U.S. here, Trump did that. He claimed that immigrants would be you know, because of the pandemic, we've got to attack immigration. Did we see that in Europe as well? And you know, what were some positive responses on immigration?
Well, first of all, we saw, unfortunately, kind of the realization of many of the far right's demands on immigration immediately after the pandemic hit. And that was basically shutting down borders. And that happened pretty much across the board, not just here in the United States, but throughout Europe, throughout the global South as well. So that was an unfortunate occurrence, obviously. But one of the unusual kind of side effects of that is it removed immigration as a political issue for the right wing. And so the right wing started to look at some other questions. And I would argue that one of the reasons why QAnon became so popular as a conspiracy theory among the far right is because the immigration issue was no longer politically useful for them. In terms of positive things that we've seen, we did see, for instance, a country like Portugal extending its healthcare services to immigrants. We saw the importance of Thailand, which had extended its, even prior to the pandemic, extended healthcare to all members of the country, whether they were immigrants or undocumented or else. And the pandemic has had virtually no impact on Thailand as a country. I mean, very, very few deaths in several dozen. So really important message to us about the importance of healthcare in general as a preventive tool against pandemics.
And then recently we also saw France has fast-tracked citizenship processes for immigrants that have been working in the health field and, you know, doing such important life-risking work to keep the French safe. And France rewarded them with a fast-track to citizenship. And we see here in the United States, immigrants form the backbone of so much of our health work. It would be amazing if we had that approach as well, although Biden has talked about a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants and DACA recipients as well. In the practical sense, very little has changed so far, although it is early days. Do you think finally, John, that there will be enough of an appetite for us to change things? I love the analogy that you open your book with, that, you know, you have a heart attack. If you survive it, the most sensible thing you can do is to look back on your lifestyle, think about all of the behaviors that led to you having a heart attack that are within your control, and you know, the right thing would be to change those lifestyle issues so that you are a healthier person as a global society. Will we change the conditions that led to the pandemic that got worse during the pandemic? It seems like we're going to need a huge effort to do that. It was already a huge effort before the pandemic for progressives to make progress.
That's correct. And, you know, obviously people are very focused on, you know, the present, you know, ensuring that vaccines are distributed, that, you know, we achieve in a responsible way, the herd immunity that will allow us to return to work. So obviously there's a desire to get back to some version of the status quo. I think it will take a little bit longer for people to realize that that status quo is simply unsustainable. Some people obviously already realize that, the folks who have been being hit by, you know, this extreme climate conditions around the world, or by being hit by, you know, the border restrictions, or being hit by economic inequality. So obviously, though, people who have already or are already experiencing these crisis situations apart from the pandemic are very clued into the fact that the status quo is unsustainable. The rest, I think we will have to, you know, really push a little harder to get the necessary legislative changes, to get the popular movements that are really necessary to get those legislation through the Congress. That's going to require organizing, as it always has. And, you know, once we get out of this pandemic situation, I think organizing will be a little easier. I mean, it's a little hard to actually, you know, organize stuff by Zoom. Once we can gather safely, I think we progressives will have an easier time, you know, pushing for a new status quo.
I want to hone in on the word pivot, which is in the title of your book. You know, the wealthy right-wing elites have taken actions that Naomi Klein characterized as the shock doctrine, taking advantage of societies in crisis. And I'm sure already there are forces working to do that. But there can be pushback from the left, pivoting away from, from the conditions that led to the crisis. Would you say something like the New Deal, when FDR responded to the Great Depression with the New Deal, was the kind of pivot that you're hoping for here, which does point to the need for really good leadership?
Absolutely. I mean, the possibility of a pivot here with a Green New Deal basically being the New Deal of our times, I think, is a very good possibility. Another possibility, let's just mention
the... I'm hard-pressed to think that Biden is the one who has what it takes to lead us into that. He just seems so reluctant to take bold action.
Well, you know, that is our responsibility to push him towards that. And you know, to a certain extent, his lack of an economic vision beyond, you know, some rote phrases is an opportunity to kind of pour our economic vision into his, you know, receptacle, if you will. But another example would be the crushing debt that so many countries around the world face. And the coronavirus has only aggravated that. But, you know, here's an opportunity to really change the terms of the debate. I mean, previously it was like some debt extensions and, you know, maybe an increase in special drawing rights at the IMF. But here's an opportunity to really transform the debate on debt to, for instance, debt climate swaps, in which countries around the world are able to use the money that they would have spent for debt servicing to really build up their sustainability, to move from away from dirty industries to preserving forests and biological diversity. So here's a real opportunity for a pivot at a global scale that addresses the most vulnerable countries, not just the middle class or the well-off countries that will, you know, probably recover reasonably quickly from this pandemic, but the ones that are most hard-pressed by this pandemic. And this is an opportunity for that kind of pivot as well.
John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My guest has been John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we've been discussing his new book, Pandemic Pivot, a report from the Institute for Policy Studies, the Transnational Institute, and Focus on the Global South. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.